It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
We've talked about everything at Farm to Table Talk, but we surprisingly don't talk about eating nearly as much as we probably should, because that's the reason that most of us have an interest in Farm to Table, because we're sitting down at the table and we're enjoying a meal, and the consequences of what we're enjoying, how we're enjoying it, how we feel about it, I mean, that's a fairly complicated thing in some respects. Some people have a really great attitude, feel good about themselves and about what they eat, the effect of what they eat. Some not so much. So to take a look at this, to take a look at how we actually are nourishing ourselves, I'm happy to welcome to Farm to Table Talk Heidi Schuster. Heidi, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you for having me, Roger.
Heidi, you are you're a dietitian. You're also an author, and you're a person that has taken special interest in how we eat, what we eat, how we feel about what we eat, what effect it has. Kind of explain that journey to me, would you? I mean, what has gotten you into this focus and attention on what we eat, how we eat, why we eat? How does eating become such a central part of your own journey?
Well, that's a great question, and it's a bit of a story. And I, you know, as a young person, I struggled with my relationship with food. I was a young dancer and had an eating disorder when I was a teen. And as I was doing my recovery work, I, you know, explored nutrition in college and ended up majoring in nutrition and psychology. Probably no surprise, given that I was on a healing journey myself, kind of finishing it up. And I really became interested in the way in which we are informed about what we should eat or shouldn't eat, and how much misinformation there is out there about that. I kind of grew up in the 1970s, the Diet Pepsi era, and everyone was dieting. And certainly as a young ballet dancer, I was, you know, instructed in some ways to diet, just by the culture around me. And I realized when I finally studied the science of nutrition that I was really grossly under eating for my active young body. And so in some ways, nutrition helped me understand how to fuel my body, the study of nutrition, and I became interested in ways in which I could apply my sort of knowledge of nutrition and my training to help people who are also struggling in their relationship with food. So that's what I've been doing for the last, 20 plus years, is working in the field of disordered eating, helping people whose relationships with food and body are challenged for one reason or another, and trying to help them come into balance with those relationships.
Well, you've written a book called Nourish, How to Heal Your Relationship with Your Food, Body, and Self.
Correct. And I just published.
Yeah, well, I read it. I really enjoyed it. And you have some real common sense, but some fresh perspectives. And I thought I'd read about everything that's been written at one time or another. But I like so much of what you presented in the book. And I think it's a direct connection I see with, again, the farm-to-table conversations. We'll kind of get into that a little bit more, too. But mm-hmm. when you talk about disorders, what percentage of the population would you consider could qualify as having an eating disorder?
Well, I think there's the research kind of shows a variety of different kinds of statistics, anything from 1% to 10%. But keep in mind that a lot of our research on the prevalence of eating disorders has to do with self-report. And I think there are a lot of people out there, and certainly there are a lot of my clients, would not really be diagnosed with anorexia or bulimia or binge eating disorder. However, they have kind of a funky relationship with food, and they, you know, they go back and forth, for example, between overeating and undereating and don't really understand why. There might be some emotional eating that they can't quite put their fingers on, and understanding. And there's lots of different reasons why we eat, of course, but I think that things can go awry quite a bit for all of us with food, because food is so connected to, you know, understanding our deeper needs and deeper hungers.
You know, there's been a lot of publicity lately about binge drinking, and I think we understand what that is. I think they go out and have like five drinks or more, you know, so people that don't necessarily get drunk every night, but they do this binge drinking, which is creates all kinds of problems. But there's binge eating, and you use that term in the book. It makes me feel a little guilty because I feel like I've been on binges before.
I think, Roger, everyone has.
Oh, okay.
It's pretty, well, not everyone, but
sure.
I think most people have probably experienced a binge, if you want to use that term. It's sort of a natural result of going too long without eating. And we all do it when we get busy or focused or maybe we're on a diet of some sort. Those types of eating behaviors, like, you know, kind of not eating enough, pretty much precipitate a binge. Also, like, kind of getting exposed to a wonderful, delicious food that we haven't had in a long time might precipitate that too. So I don't think it's necessarily a pathological problem, but I think if it ends up happening frequently, then it's worth looking at, you know, what else might be behind that.
You know, I've heard theories before that coming out of the Depression, our grandparents going through the Depression, and maybe our parents were young kids, you know, soon after the Depression. And then after World War II, you come back and everybody could get everything from TV dinners and smorgasbords started, you know, popping up. And people were almost kind of responding as a society, just like, fill it up, go get the all-you-can-eat deals and all-you-can-eat meals, because you don't know whether that next meal is going to be around. It's is there anything to that, you know, the time in a society that there'd just be even more temptations on binge eating, like the all-you-can-eat smorgasbords?
Sure. I mean, I think there's a lot of history and kind of cultural perspectives on this issue, and that certainly could be one of them. I also think, you know, the availability of food, you know, the fact that it's on every street corner, you know, and very accessible makes it, you know, sort of easy to abuse, I guess you could say, if I want to use that term, to almost use, you know, it's a much more legal way to maybe numb when there are difficult feelings that don't want to be recognized. It's a sort of a easy way to feel some kind of control in your life. Like, you know, if you could just manage your food and just make it perfect and clean, which is kind of a recent trend. I think this sort of like almost over-focus on health that we have now in our culture can really cause some problems. And I think it makes food both feel more scarce because we're trying to eat perfectly and cleanly, but then there's a moral kind of piece attached to it. So there's lots of different factors.
I feel compelled to make a confession that I remember going, we had a big family dinner one time where everybody ate so much, you know, go back and fill their plate like three times, and everybody was having fat pains. And we actually filled the car and drove to Target and bought everybody sweatpants because it was more comfortable.
Uh-huh.
That's not a good idea. And I'd have to say that everybody's kind of back on the right track again.
Well, I think that's, you know, I think food is one of those pleasures in life, and we have to appreciate that it is a pleasure, and that it's a way that we celebrate lots of different occasions. There's so many associations, and it's so also attached to our most basic needs. I really think the first, you know, the first thing we called out for on this planet is some kind of nourishment. And you can't really feed a baby, whether it's, you know, breast or bottle, really, you can't feed a baby without cuddling and providing comfort. So we, you know, comfort and pleasure and safety and nurturance are all kind of tied up in food. So I think we have, you know, I have a lot of compassion for those kinds of episodes that you just described, because I think that, you know, I think they're, you know, they happen for a reason. You know, food is designed to be pleasurable and enjoyable. And I think most of the time it's pretty easy to stay in balance with food. Kids do it really well, very, very young kids, until they start to get messages about what they should and shouldn't eat. And then they start kind of using their mind to make choices about food instead of their bodies. And then things get a little bit more funky, I think, with our relationship with food. When we start kind of trying to think about, well, what's the best thing I should eat, or how much should I eat? And then we rebound from that by overeating because we've been trying to be so good all week. I don't know if that was anything that fed into that episode.
Yeah, no, I think it is. I mean, for me, when I heard what I wanted to hear from you on that is that don't beat yourself up on pigging out at Thanksgiving dinner.
Of course.
Yeah, you know, that happens. And go ahead, sure, and enjoy the pumpkin pie. And in fact, that's one of the messages I got from your book. One thing you're right up front with, you're not a fan of diets. And in fact, my takeaway is, like, don't diet.
Yes.
And could you explain that?
Well, dieting, like I said a little while ago, it's like it's a much more mind-driven activity, and it tends to create a state of deprivation in some way. Whether it's you're depriving yourself of like actual calories, actual food energy, or you're depriving yourself of particular food groups or food types, you know, you're setting up a feeling of deprivation on some level, both physiologically and psychologically. And generally what happens is that's not sustainable. In fact, the research shows that 95% of anyone who goes, 95% of people who go on any kind of a diet to reduce weight will gain that weight back, you know, generally plus more. And that's just not good odds, which is why as a nutrition therapist and registered dietitian, I don't do weight loss counseling. This doesn't feel ethical. But what I can do is help people examine their habits around food and, you know, try to develop a relationship with food that feels more balanced. And dieting tends to really mess that up. You're either on the diet or you're off the diet. You're going back and forth. And it's generally not very sustainable. And if you are sustaining the diet, often you're doing it at a great cost to the rest of your life. You're having to put a lot of time and energy and effort into managing your food that could really be put into, you know, other pursuits that maybe are, you know, more meaningful in your life. So I think that's where dieting does a disservice. And it's a $60 billion industry, so it will always be there because it's really based on the fact that it doesn't work. And so you'll come back for the next diet book or diet plan or diet product. It's sort of like the beauty industry. If we all felt like we were beautiful, then we probably wouldn't buy that face cream. So They kind of have to make us feel bad about ourselves in order to buy it. So they put these flawless models in the ads. So.
Well, I mean, I was thinking just as I was getting ready to talk to you this morning, I saw several ads on TV that were promoting diet plans. But one thing, to some of the credit, they're trying to get people into a life plan that has some indulgence in it and so forth, but still it's a regimen that it's very different from what you're suggesting, and in fact I want to come back to something else that you talk about, and I think I got to think back and say attitude about your self-image. You make a point, maybe you could explain this, of being okay with yourself. I mean, accepting that we don't all have to look like, you know, somebody that goes on the cover of a magazine.
Right. Well, I think you're right. You know, my book has 10 steps in it, and they're not linear steps, but number two is body acceptance. And I think I say body acceptance, if not love. And it's wonderful if you can get to body love, but, you know, at least getting to body acceptance can be quite helpful in this process, because generally when we don't feel good about ourselves, when we're really feeling negative, when we're beating ourselves up, we don't generally make good choices. It's not an ideal situation for creating change in our lives. So in some ways, you know, accepting where we're at, even if we don't like every nook and cranny of our bodies, but sort of accepting that, okay, this is the body that I have. It has a lot of history. I'm just going to take it one day at a time and take the best care of it that I can, appreciating the things about my body that, you know, that it is doing for me, which, you know, our bodies are kind of miraculous if you really, really think about it. Instead of, you know, focusing on the negative or the things that we want to fix or change. And I find that when people are really able to shift that mindset, and it generally takes a bit of work if they've, like, developed some real loathing of their bodies, that shift can really create change and create good self-care practices to emerge. And that might be around food or physical activity or sleep or whatever, but it's very hard to do that when you're beating yourself up.
Well, and then one other thing that you talk about too is that there's been a lot of studies that are showing that people there's a correlation with longevity and being what would be considered overweight. I can't remember the specifics on that, but that people that live longer are actually oftentimes what we categorize as overweight by the way we define overweight right now.
Yeah, I don't love those terms, you know, obese and overweight. You know, they are what is often used in the medical system to refer to the BMI chart. But if you really look at the research, life expectancy tends to go down, you know, when you're at the lowest BMI, when you're super thin, and when you're at the highest BMI, what we would consider, I don't love to use the word obese, but someone who's very, very high on that chart and someone who's very, very low might have the lowest life expectancy. And the people who have actually the most favorable life expectancy, I think it's like death from all causes, and it's just the most positive, are people who are actually considered in the overweight category on the BMI chart. So that's why I'm puzzled by this term overweight, because technically that doesn't necessarily mean that someone is unhealthy at all. In fact, you know, what we can see in the research is that habits around health, you know, habits around food and physical activity, stress, other health-related habits are significant in terms of, you know, predicting health and longevity. But weight is not really correlated at all. It may be correlated with certain behaviors. For example, people who tend to be not so physically active tend to be of a higher weight, but that's not always the case. We can't make that generalization at all. So the fact that we vilify weight per se is problematic, I think, in our medical field. It's really more about the habits that people have. And someone can be in a larger body but be very fit. And someone can be very thin and just happen to be naturally thin because of their genetics and actually have lots of habits that aren't particularly moving them towards health. So I think trying to, like, categorize a whole body type as unhealthy is really, really problematic, and it just stigmatizes people who fall into that category. So, that's something, that's a whole big conversation we can have.
Well, no, we don't have to have a whole big conversation about it, but it does make me wonder about whether some of those people are just a little happier. Maybe, you know, the fact that they listen to their own body. I mean, they're enjoying some of the things they like to enjoy. And you make that point. You I can't articulate it. You did a good job in your book, but it's hard for me to articulate the fact that you kind of listen to your body. I mean, and that if your body is kind of telling you in a way of the kind of foods and what food you should eat.
Yeah, I mean, our bodies have a lot of wisdom. We have all this interesting physiology that tells us when we're hungry and tells us when we're full and tells us, like, when, you know, it kind of keeps us at the weight that we're supposed to be at, for example, to be healthy, if we actually really listen to it and follow it. Most of my clients who are sort of in a recovery place from their disordered eating find that their weight kind of stabilizes, actually, and stays the same year after year after year. It may not be what they expected, you know, might be a little higher than they expected or a little lower, or you know, could exactly be the same. But their bodies kind of regulate to where they're supposed to be when they're really listening to their cues, and then they enjoy food more. It doesn't feel as stressful. They don't have to manage it so much. And that's really a beautiful thing when I see that happen.
But they're not necessarily going to know whether their weight changes, because one other suggestion you make is don't step on the scales.
Right. I think that putting that number, giving it too much, you know, power is really problematic, because when we step on a scale, then we automatically think, well, I'm going to have to manage this. And then we make food choices based on managing that number. So yes, I recommend that we don't get so tied up in weight. You know, if you go once a year for your physical and you get a weight there, that will give you an indication of if there's any changes that are, you know, problematic, for example, for particular disease states. But otherwise, we don't really need to be stepping on that scale, ultimately. Like, we really just need to be checking in with ourselves. How is our body feeling? Like, how does it feel when I eat this kind of meal? How does it feel when I eat that kind of meal? Like, how does it feel when I do exercise to this intensity? How does it feel when I go for a, like, brisk walk? And, you know, just kind of noticing what feels good for us. Everybody is so unique and different. And generally, when we find those self-care practices that feel really resonant for us, that creates balance, and our bodies are healthier. I really believe that.
You know, when you say that, how you feel when you eat different things, I'm thinking that one of my biggest weaknesses would be chips and dip. I could just love the taste of potato chips and, like, French onion dip or something like that. And it feels great mm-hmm. when I taste it. And then mm-hmm. an hour later, it's horrible. You know, I just can't believe I did it. I feel guilty about it. And I don't feel very good either. I mean, it's, mm-hmm. but the taste itself is such a kick. It's hard to resist.
Well, and then what I might do if someone, you know, if you don't mind being a guinea pig,
sure.
what I might do if someone came to me and had that concern, I might have them experiment, and this is, you know, something you can do on your own with, like, okay, well, if I really like that taste and it's really enjoyable for me and that sort of sensory food moment is really positive, like, play around with how much. Like, it might be that
yeah.
if you have some of that, you know, on the side with a sandwich and with, like, a balanced meal, then actually it feels fine in your body, and it's, like, a reasonable amount of your, you know, your favorite snack food, and it, like, you know, and you get that pleasure and enjoyment from it, but it doesn't leave you feeling ill afterwards. And, you know, I don't know why, you know, the feeling
yeah.
ill afterwards could be about quantity, or it could be that, you know, your body doesn't like that much, you know, oily, salty food all at once. I mean, who knows? I mean, every body is really different, but I think you could do that experiment yourself and see, like, well, how can I eat this pleasurable food and still feel good afterwards? And then you come up with that solution.
You know, you're on the East Coast. You're around Boston. I'm in California. We have In-N-Out Burger, which you probably have heard of. And In-N-Out Burger, it's really good. All they have is hamburgers and french fries. But you can go in there and you can order a special one that doesn't have a bun, that just has lettuce. You know, and hardly anything else. It doesn't taste very good. It's, you know, missing something with the bread. I mean, again, in your book, you kind of give permission, it seems like, or allow you to give permission to, enjoy bread. You don't have to, you know, take that extreme position one way or the other. you know, that you put in a good word for pasta and breads, the carbohydrates.
Well, I think again, all bodies are really different. Personally, for me, a burger isn't a burger if it doesn't look like a burger with a bun. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like I wouldn't like, and I'm not such a carnivorous person that like sitting and eating a burger by itself would actually be appealing to me. Like I like the whole package with the pickles and the ketchup and everything. That's my preference. For someone else, actually, you know, it might be different. So I'm not going to create, you know, any kind of a particular judgment about that. I try to stay really neutral about food in general. And some people actually have discovered that they are sensitive, for example, to gluten, like that it can be a real thing for some people. It's unfortunately sort of trendy to just cut it out entirely. And I think we have to be careful of that because that can create some dietary imbalance and can also create some of that like rebound overeating because you're restricting a food group so harshly. But, you know, for some people, actually, they don't feel good when they eat, you know, traditional wheat flour foods. And so they might do that experiment and decide that. So I certainly don't want to exclude those that have celiac disease and really can't eat those foods or those that have a real sensitivity or an allergy. But for the rest of the people, which is most of us, actually, you know, those foods are pleasurable and enjoyable and in moderation can be eaten in such a way that tends to create more balance. And I think when we try to cut out whole foods, whole food groups, especially those that we actually like, you know, if you go to that In-N-Out burger and you joint and you'd like, you know, get your burger and it like, it's not really satisfying. Chances are you're going to be foraging for snacks in the afternoon to make up for the fact that that, you know, sensory moment wasn't so great. Whereas if you order what you really want to eat, whatever that is, you're more likely to be satisfied and then be able to move on with your life for the afternoon. And that's, I think, a sort of holistic view of nutrition, which is a little bit different than the nutrition I studied, for example. That was a little bit more regimented.
Well, and you point out that when you get down to nutrition, you're talking about what carbohydrates and fats and proteins and you know, minerals and vitamins and so forth. At first, I was ready to call you last night when I was reading your book and take exception because you were pointing out the carbohydrates. And what I thought you were going towards was carbohydrates are carbohydrates, which is like everything that's not fats or proteins. But in fact, you later acknowledged there's a difference in carbohydrates and you know, you're going to get something more out of vegetables than white bread. You know, clearly you need to take into consideration, I guess, nutritionally, that you're getting vegetables, and you do say that too, that, you know, work them in. You get fruits and vegetables are part of what you have your guidelines that you should have every day, but not cutting out extreme cutouts of anything else.
Yes, I mean, what creates, I believe, you know, based on the science, the most healthy, kind of nourishing way to eat is a lot of variety. And that means like on a daily basis, having plenty of protein and grain and vegetables and fruits and fats and, you know, a wide variety of colors. You know, obviously, you know, I'm a big fan of shopping at farmers markets and eating whole foods. And I have my own vegetable garden. You know, I believe in all of that because I do think our bodies and the planet benefit from the choices that we make. However, I don't put that, that's my value. And I think everybody has to kind of figure out their own health values, their own sort of emphasis and what's valuable in their life and make choices about food related to that. And I think what happens a lot in our, you know, in our sort of health messages that are out there is it kind of like makes people feel like they're going to be good if they do one thing or they're going to be bad if they do another thing. And I think that's really problematic. It doesn't really give people the opportunity to create a really well-balanced diet that that where all different kinds of foods are appropriate and enjoyable. And, you know, then we go on and do the other things in life that that matter to us. So I think you know, it's kind of leveling the playing field around food.
Well, what I like so much about what the way you talk about this is that you get a chance to recognize, you know, you can eat the food you like. I mean, you find the balance, mm-hmm. and you don't have to feel like when you're sitting with a group of people, say, well, I'm just going to have the salad, make sure the dressing's on the side, and, you know, so you're not pouring too much dressing on, and don't bring the bread to the table. You know, that I know some people have to do that, but that's kind of extreme, and sure not as much fun as getting the broader offering.
Right, and it can really set you up later on to find yourself foraging at night in your cupboards, wondering, like, what sweet thing can you eat because you haven't eaten enough carbohydrates during the day? And I think, you know, for the most part, I do this experiment with my clients all the time, and I tell them, okay, for just 2 weeks, you know, you can go back to eating the way you've always been eating after 2 weeks. For just 2 weeks, I want to do an experiment with you. I want you to add back in some more of those grain-rich carbohydrate foods that you've been cutting out, you know. Add back in, you know, and let's see what happens. And then you can just go back to doing whatever you're doing. And lo and behold, they realize not only are they not craving sweets anymore, or foraging at the end of the night, but they're also, like, they have more focus. Their workouts are better because they actually have muscle glycogen stores, so they recover the next day and can go back to their, you know, their swim or their run or whatever they do, feeling better. Actually, what I see more often than not in all different body sizes is that people aren't eating enough. And then what happens is they make up for it later in the day, you know, with snack food, because their bodies are such good regulators around that. And so I think just kind of being more, like, trying to be more moderate and not so rigid about what we choose to eat during the day can be really, really helpful.
You know, I have to mention here, too, that you have the same kind of philosophy carried over into exercise, that I think you talk about that, you know, it's important to have movement. I mean, I believe you talked about your grandfather and your grandmother and they, you know, just staying active, whether it's housework, whether it's carrying your golf clubs. Just staying active. Some people may want to go hardcore to the gym and lift weights, but for others, it's just plenty to make sure they're getting in a 20-minute walk every day. Seems that you apply the same philosophy to the exercise part of living as you do to our diets.
Yes, and I think we are designed to move. We have these bodies that move, and obviously I am, I don't want to be ableist when I say that. Obviously every body is different, and some people's bodies are more capable than others around movement. I want to acknowledge that, of course, but in general, like, you know, our bodies are designed to move, and we have a society that's kind of built more and more around screens these days. So in some ways we have to sort of create more balance for ourselves in movement, but it doesn't have to be this extreme, you know, this extreme form of exercise for everyone. I mean, some people actually that feels really good for them. Like, you know, some of my clients really manage their anxiety levels by doing regular exercise, and it, you know, it works better than their, you know, antidepressant medicines. So I think, you know, physical activity can be really helpful on lots of different levels. But I think we also can take that to an extreme, just like dieting, and it can become compulsive, and it cannot be really attached to how our bodies are feeling. You know, if we're really kind of tired and exhausted, and we say, oh, well, I'm going to go out and run anyway, you know, maybe we're going to get injured, or we're going to, over time, you know, not take good care of our stress system. So I think we have to kind of also balance that and really feel connect, you know, make decisions that are really connected to our bodies.
Well, Heidi, people are going to have to check out the book sometime. And Nourish, N-O-U-R-I-S-H, can they find it on Amazon?
They can find it on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and find booksellers everywhere if you ask for it. And if you don't see it, please ask for it because it's available. But you can also buy it on my website as well.
And what's that?
Where you, and that is, you know, it's anourishingword.com. So it's anourishingword, W-O-R-D.com. And there's also, you know, other information there about the work that I do and my approach. And I do send out seasonal newsletters with a blog post around these themes for those that are interested in exploring a little bit more.
Well, Heidi, I just want to wrap up then on one other thing that I thought was important in the book, and it really registered with me, and this makes a connection back to farm to table, I think, because you talk about mindfulness, and you talk about the to try to get yourself right, both of the way you eat and you exercise and move and so forth, but the time to kind of think and be grateful and the gratitude, and I saw in that the connection too, to be able to think about how your food is grown. And in fact, I think the term is in there, maybe you were looking to some other people that made comments on this too, about the food that has been well grown, that if you slow down and think about your food and think about how it got to the table, who it was grown by, whether it was well grown and so forth, that somehow fits into the sort of almost a kind of a system of living. Am I reading too much into that?
No, I don't think so at all. You're right on. Mindfulness is a big theme in the book, and that's a big theme around eating and living. But that appreciation and gratitude that we have for the miracle that is our food, like not only that we have it to eat, you know, so abundantly, and we're certainly grateful that we live in a country where that's the case, but also that this food came to us, like probably in so many different ways. And there's so many people that have sort of touched this food and brought it to our table, and to just be grateful for all of those hands, you know, from the farmer to the the truck driver to just kind of appreciate like that, you know, this food that we're giving to ourselves is a gift. Just it helps you sort of connect with the food on a deeper level, and also appreciate that act of nourishing yourself, of feeding yourself even more. And that if it connects with your values, particularly to do that as it does with mine, then it can make those choices around food a little bit easier too. Just thinking about like, okay, well, what's important to me? How do I want to be eating? You may make a choice to go to a farmer's market if that's something that is important to you, if you really value that connection to the land. You might plant your own garden, for example, if that's important to you, and then be able to appreciate food that you've grown. It's a wonderful thing to do with children, for example. So, that's just one piece of the picture, but I think it's an important one.
Well, it all fits together, and I really appreciate your sharing this story, and I'm glad that you've been with us here on Farm to Table Talk. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Roger, for having me. I really appreciate it. It's been great to talk to you.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.